when I read Seeing Voices, I was very interested in and very touched by it. And I do have a lot of questions about it. It's absolutely fascinating. Apparently, your interest in deafness occurred when you ran across the name Harlan Lane. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, well, until the summer of 1985, I think I hadn't met a deaf person and I hadn't thought about what it might mean to be deaf. And it was a revelation for me when I was sent this book of Harlan Lane, When the Mind Hears, A History of the Deaf. I was sent it to review. And the book astonished me, and what it related outraged and stimulated me. And when I put it down, I felt I had to get into the subject for myself and embark on a sort of exploration. I think it made me think for the first time about what it might mean to someone, to a human being, not to have language or not to have good language. This is something I'd never thought about before. As a neurologist, I'd seen patients with aphasia, with brain damage, which had caused them to lose their use of language, but these were already formed human beings. I'd never imagined it might be possible to develop without any language. And so I'd never thought about this, but this is something which may happen to those who are born deaf if they're not exposed to good language. Nor had I thought what it might be like to have a completely different mode of language, a visual language, and how this might lead to a sort of a different world. I'd really never thought about questions of language and its relation to thought, its relation to culture, until I read Harlan Lane. But I think the deaf allow one a very special perspective on themes like this.
Well, let's get down to some basics. What does the term deaf actually mean?
Well, of course, it means different things. Perhaps I should say that I only concern myself in what I write with those who are profoundly deaf, that's to say, who even with the best amplification really cannot make sense of the sounds of speech. And specifically also those who are either born deaf or who lose their hearing before the acquisition of language. And so that learning language becomes a major problem. If one loses one's hearing, say at the age of 9 or 11, one already has language, one already has a well-formed auditory imagination, and though the problems can be very great, they're not the same, they're less radical.
So there, apparently in the past, there's been a confusion. A deaf person is considered an imbecile or mentally damaged in some form.
Yes, this was, and we have words like deaf and dumb in every language, and dumb partly meaning apparently mute or unable to speak, and partly unable to think. This was a very general opinion before 1750. And it was only then when an extraordinary French priest, the Abbé de la Paix in Paris, paid attention to deaf people for the first time and started to learn their language, the sign language they'd created, and to start education for the deaf. Within 20 years of this, there started to be deaf authors and deaf intellectuals, which was a revelation. No one had imagined that this might be so before 1750.
You say in Seeing Voices that being completely deaf is probably worse than being blind. Can you explain that?
Well, I think what I say is that being born deaf exposes one to a very special sort of hazard, which maybe being born blind doesn't. And the hazard is not being able to communicate properly, not acquiring language properly, and with this not becoming a full part of the culture, but remaining isolated and quite disabled. This is what I started to see for myself when I started to go to some schools for the deaf. I describe one boy I saw, Joseph, who had somehow reached the age of 11 without having any language. he'd been born in a remote part of Mexico, and when he didn't start to speak in the normal way, he'd been regarded as an imbecile or retarded or autistic or something. And it was and it was very, very pitiful to see him in this state. I'd never before seen an intelligent, and he was obviously intelligent, but an intelligent 11-year-old with no language. And this, subsequently I saw other deaf people whom I describe in the book who had been acquired visual language or other language in the earliest years of life and were doing very well. So it's not being born deaf, it's what happens later which makes all the difference.
David Wright, South African poet and novelist, he wrote a book called Deafness. You referred to this book in your own. He was deaf, I think you said, by the age of 7. What did you learn from David Wright?
This is a lovely book. David Wright is a poet and a novelist, and he writes beautifully out of his own experience. This was really the first experience which was conveyed to me. David Wright had already established language and hearing language before this happened. One of the fascinating things he describes is how when he lip reads people, he seems to hear their voice. He endows them with a phantasmal voice, as he calls it. Of course, in a way, this is a sort of hallucination or a product of his imagination. But his nervous system and the nervous system of those who have already heard and used auditory language is quite different from those who are born deaf. But David Wright sort of compares his state in his own book. He went to a school and there encountered some people who had been born deaf and who didn't have language, and he felt there was a great gulf between them. He felt that he was very lucky, if it had to be his fate to become deaf at the age he did, when he had already acquired language but was also plastic enough to adapt completely.
Sign. What is sign?
Well, wherever there are any numbers of deaf people, they create a sign language of their own in which meanings are expressed with the hands and the face and the body. It's a visual language. There's not one sign language. There are hundreds of different sign languages. For example, American Sign Language is somewhat closer to French Sign Language, from which it's partly derived, and quite different from British Sign Language. The sign languages were often regarded as pantomimes or sort of broken English on the hands, and it's only been relatively recently that their proper status as languages has been established, the fact that they have elaborate grammar and syntax and can express anything which spoken language can.
You have some charts in this book showing all the nuances that sign has. I was absolutely amazed. I had no idea. I thought it was a very primitive way of communicating, but apparently it is very sophisticated.
Oh, I think one of the things which brought this home to me was when I went to Gallaudet, this unique university for the deaf, which I first did in 86, and I went to some of the classes in mathematics and chemistry and philosophy, and one saw that this apparently primitive language, in fact, can allow any sort of abstract communication or thought.
As well as proper English?
I think so. I mean, obviously, English can do some things which maybe French doesn't do quite as well, or French does better, but given these relatively minor differences, I think that any form of emotional or dramatic or intellectual communication and thought, because one uses language to think to some extent, can be done with a sign language.
How does British sign differ from American?
Well, many of the particular signs, the vocabulary is different in every sign language. and may, for example, depend somewhat on the social customs. For example, I gather that in Chinese sign language that saying hello and goodbye may involve a sort of representation of figures bowing to one another, but this is a Chinese custom. The grammar in different sign languages is somewhat similar, and this leads to a very interesting situation whereby deaf people can learn each other's languages much fairly quickly. There was recently a festival in Washington where deaf people from 80 different countries with 80 different sign languages came, but by the end of the week they were all managing to communicate with one another pretty well. It wasn't a Babel. And it was really extraordinary, and one saw that potentially one could have a sort of global deaf community, whereas you certainly, whereas the rest of us are all very divided by our spoken languages.
Well, if an American, a deaf person, were to travel to Europe, would he have difficulty?
Well, in the first hour or two, he'd have much less difficulty than a speaking American who say, went to Paris. Now, a signing American who met his deaf brothers in Paris, he certainly established some sort of communication, partly by gesture and partly by a sort of pidgin, a contact language, within a few hours. But within days, they would have established all sorts of conventions, linguistic conventions, and have learned each other's languages to a considerable extent. And recently there have been some joint productions by the Japan Theatre of the Deaf and the American Theatre of the Deaf. One can't imagine anything like that in spoken English and Japanese.
But sign is really applicable only to the deaf. It's not practical, is it, as a mode of communication between the deaf and those who are not?
Well, I don't know. Another book which fascinated me, which I read and reviewed at the end of 85, was about a community on Martha's Vineyard where there'd been a hereditary deafness. At one time, one in five people had been deaf. And the response of the hearing community of the island was that they all learned sign. And the hearing and deaf alike conversed in sign. I think there's been some interesting work recently in Maryland, where hearing children allowed to learn sign language in kindergarten. They love it. They're very fond of it. And interestingly, it seems to accelerate their reading and some of their powers of visual memory and visual imagery. And I think, again, that there's some arts of the deaf, the theatre of the deaf and forms of sign poetry, which are very beautiful and interesting, don't have any exact equivalent in speech. And perhaps all of us should know a little bit of other languages, and I think this is a particularly interesting one.
Edward Gallaudet, what was his contribution to our understanding of the deaf?
Well, he first was the son of the man who brought sign language to America in 1817, along with a French teacher of the deaf. He himself was a native signer because his mother was deaf, and sign language to him was as natural and native as speech. And he was also a sort of organizational genius, and at the age of 20 he became superintendent of a school for the deaf, which within a few years received its charter from Abraham Lincoln and became what is now Gallaudet College or University. But he made it possible for deaf people to receive a higher education and be recognized as intellectually the peers of anybody.
Do you do sign?
My own signing is sort of rudimentary, and I'm generally rather bad at languages, which is a paradox since I've partly written a book about language. I'm also sort of shy. I also sometimes get my signs confused, so, well, we're, only on radio, but, for example, the sign for happy to meet you. I sometimes say sorry to meet you by mistake. Well, but it's lovely to try and learn it. And I think even someone who is relatively elderly, like myself, and rather bad at languages, you know, certainly has a fair chance of picking up some, enough to make contact and enough to be fun and interesting.
But I would presume that sign, like any other language, is something you have to stay with and practice.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Right, sure.
You can learn the French in high school or college, and if you don't use it for many years, it's
right,
gone.
Yeah. Well, certainly...
The only French phrase I know today is the one that got me all through France, Lady Schoenfiebel play. you can do anything with that.
Right, right. I now find that I have a lot of deaf friends, and I'm beginning to find myself a little bit in a society, in a world which I think is a fascinating one, and you know, in a very congenial one. Sometimes I think one with a sort of warmth which one doesn't always see in the outside world, and it's very nice to have contact with this special culture in our midst.
Well, I believe there is a discrimination against the deaf. I put back my own experience in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Every year, maybe twice a year, the Board of Education would send someone to school to check our hearing. They have these various tuning forks. They use electronic equipment now, but those days they test your hearing. Right, ding. And I would inevitably fail. And so I remember at one point, I think I was a sophomore, freshman in high school, I failed the hearing test, and so they assigned me to a remedial class for students with various handicaps, speech handicaps. So, I mean, there were people there who obviously had difficulty. There were a couple of people who had hair lips who had very difficult time speaking. And it was clear that my diction in English, very, very good, because my hearing loss would come and go. And it didn't take the teacher long to figure out that I didn't need that class, and I was excused from it after a bit. But it was an automatic reaction. This person is deaf or has a major hearing problem, so he has to go into a special class.
Right. Well, I think deaf people do get very discriminated against in education, in employment, and in society generally. And although they can do anything and anything pretty well except hear, and or one should say they can do anything as well as anybody else except hear. And I think this is changing somewhat. Perhaps some of the changes go back to the Second World War, when many deaf people were employed in munitions factories, and then not simply as workers, but sometimes as foremen, and it was realized they were as good as anyone else. Now, of course, there are quite a number of deaf professionals. There are 600 or 700 deaf people with PhDs, but on the whole, deaf people still get a bad deal in education and in employment and in life generally. And although I think this is changing, and I think some of the extraordinary revolt, the revolution at Gallaudet last year, which I describe in my book, may have done something not only to give deaf people a sense of confidence and power, but to make everyone else aware of their situation.
Now, Dr. Sass, in your book with this beautifully ironic title, Same Voices, you discuss a controversy over oralism, which apparently is teaching the deaf to speak on an oral basis. Now, what is wrong with teaching them that?
Nothing's wrong with teaching them. What's wrong is forcing them. In the nature of things, a deaf person can't pick up speech automatically by just looking the way a hearing person, he can't pick it up automatically just as a hearing person does. Speech has to be taught in a very laborious way, which takes thousands of hours and may also take thousands of hours away from his general education. And it may take years and years to accomplish. My feeling here is that, first of all, one must give the child a chance to learn a language easily, which means a deaf child, which means a sign language. Subsequently, he can read and write English, and perhaps he can speak. But what seems to me dangerous in oralism is forbidding sign, which indeed was done formally in 1880. The use of sign language was forbidden in education. What I think is dangerous is forbidding sign and forcing a child to speak and wasting valuable years until the child at the age of 7 or 8 may be called an oral failure and then perhaps allowed to sign. But the golden years for learning languages are before the age of 5.
Can't both be taught simultaneously, perhaps?
Well, certainly sign language doesn't inhibit speech, and if a child can use both, then fine. But he must have one good language. Otherwise, the mind doesn't develop properly, the nervous system doesn't develop properly.
You made a reference to some genetic deafness on Martha's Vineyard. What was that about?
Well, there are various forms of hereditary deafness. Most of them are recessive, and only in the special conditions on an island with isolation and intermarriage, the incidence of deafness increase. And as I mentioned at one point in the last century, something like 1 in 5 people were born deaf in certain villages. Nora Gross wrote a beautiful book about this, and she describes how in interviewing people it was sometimes oddly difficult to get information, because she'd say, Ebenezer, was he deaf? But he'd be remembered as a good friend or a fisherman or a neighbor or a prankster. And she'd say, yes, but was he deaf? And people would think for a long while and say, well, come to think of it, he was deaf. And they'd add, but of course we never thought of it, he was just the same as everybody else. And so this is really a remarkable situation of not even perceiving deafness where there's full integration in the society. I think one begins to see a hint of this in certain towns like Rochester, New York, and Fremont, California, where there's a very large deaf population, and the deaf and hearing populations start to mingle a bit at social events and cafes and in the scouts and swimming clubs. And that's lovely to see.
The deaf obviously have a difficult time when it comes to using the telephone, but one wonderful... I'm sorry. You
remember? No, go on.
I was just going to say, I was thinking about the use of computers and modems, which probably has caused a revolution among the deaf.
Well, a thing called the TTY, the teletype, has... I've got a teletype now attached, which I can attach to my phone. I couldn't phone my deaf friends otherwise, and they couldn't phone each other without this. And
how does that work exactly?
Well, you type your message, and then you get it back on a screen.
Well, isn't that the way a computer and a modem works?
Yes, except here one just has a transmission device without a computer. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, one can have both, but TTYs can be made very, very portable now, and so one can use them with a public telephone. And it's made an immense difference to the deaf. No, although deaf people feel their own sign language is tremendously important, they have no objection to a technology which will help them, like TTYs, or in Japan, where deaf people don't have finger spelling and Japanese is different, the deaf people in Japan use faxes for long-distance communication.
Do you have a lot of deaf friends?
I'm beginning to have some now. And
did these friends develop as a result of the research you did on the book?
Yes, and then, you know, someone knows someone and knows someone. And if there are genuine shared interests, then the fact of deafness ceases to matter and sort of after a while is forgotten.
You mentioned the revolution at Gallaudet University a year or so ago. What was that all about?
Well, although the university was given its charter by Lincoln in the 1860s, it had never had a deaf president And apart from Edward Gallaudet, who founded it, it had never really had a president who was fluent in sign language and who really knew what it was like being a member of their community and culture. And they felt very strongly that they needed one of their own to represent them and to understand them. They felt that they had always been denied this by hearing people, that they'd been patronized, been told that they must have a hearing person in charge. And so last year they made this statement very clearly and strongly and politically, no, we want one of our own. You know, a deaf person can also be president of the university. And although I'm not a political person myself, I was intrigued by this event and sort of went down and found myself part of it. It was full of passion and energy, and also I think a sort of good humour. And as everyone knows, it was completely successful in a week. And
now who's the president now?
The president now is a man called King Jordan.
He's deaf.
Yeah, he lost his hearing at from a motorcycle accident when he was 21. And his own speech is reasonably good, or indeed very good, as is often the case with people who have spoken first and then become deaf. But he is also beautifully fluent in sign language, and I think now thinks in sign language, and is a very complete member of the, you know, of the special linguistic community of the deaf.
Did the students welcome your presence on the campus? Or were they suspicious?
Both. I think there's a feeling, you know, who is this hearing guy? What's he doing? And what's he want? I think there's originally some of this feeling if I get up and talk, as I've been doing all over the country, about the book. And then, after a while, I think many of them are startled, and they realize that I'm not trying to put anything over, but my attempt has really been to listen to them, to try and understand them, and to try and represent some of their own perspectives and their world. And I think although the deaf hate pity or condescension, and rightly so, I think they welcome any genuine interest and fellow feeling.
What someone who was born deaf but manages to learn sign and perhaps goes on to college, say, Gallaudet, what sort of jobs would they qualify for? In my own professional experience, I cannot think of working ever with anyone who is deaf.
Well, I mean, one of the very few jobs they couldn't do, obviously, is radio. They can do television.
But by the same token, we have a lot of jobs that don't require one going on the air. We have...
Right. Yes. Yes. Of course. Right. Yes.
Many writers and
Yes. Yes. Oh. Yeah. Well, there are many deaf writers and deaf technicians, and down at Gallaudet they have their own entirely deaf sort of television studios. Yesterday I was talking to Marley Matlin, who is a wonderful actress who is deaf. There are many deaf professionals. There are linguists. There are chemists. There are journalists, there are photographers, there are 25 deaf attorneys in the States, not enough, but some. There are really not enough deaf doctors, or at least doctors who are native signers, so deaf people sometimes have a hard time getting adequate, immediate sort of medical advice. Until about 1940 or 50, it was probably most deaf people became printers or had relatively mechanical jobs, and still on the whole the job level is too low. I think, as you indicate, that the computer industries have provided an enormous sort of suitable realm for many deaf people.
Yeah, I think so. What is your role? Do you teach at Rockefeller?
At Einstein. I'm a neurologist. I see patients. I teach medical students. I do some research. I write books.
I know that.
Here, in a sense, and I'm going to do the same with two other forthcoming books, to some extent, I've got out of the hospital and the clinic, and to some extent out of a purely medical or clinical point of view, to look at people in the wide world and wonder what is it like to sort of, you know, to be born deaf and to use a different language in America or England or Japan or whatever. And so perhaps at this point medicine becomes a sort of anthropology, although that's rather a lot of syllables, and I think is a bit too cold sounding for what I feel to be the sort of sympathetic study which I want to make. I want to try and enter other people's worlds as best I can, as much as I'm permitted to, and sort of try and portray these. I think that prejudice isn't built in. It's acquired. For example, hearing children and deaf children play very happily together. I think various forms of prejudice and discrimination are learned later, and that if a sympathetic and intelligible and human portrait of the deaf is presented, then I think social attitudes could change, and educational attitudes, and all sorts of things. And though, as I say, I'm not political by nature, but regard myself as an explorer, yet if as a sort of spin-off there is some change in consciousness, I'd be very pleased, and it would be a very nice thing.
Your first book was Migraine, wasn't it?
Right.
I used to get terrible migraine headaches. They're almost always predictable. I don't get them anymore.
Uh-huh.
They stop. Whenever I went to Bloomingdale's, for example, I would get a headache, and my wife used to say, because I was afraid of spending money, if I went to a motion picture, I would get a migraine. It was inevitable. I got to the point that if I had to go out and do shopping or plan to go to see a movie, I would take aspirin before I left the house, and that always helped.
For some reason, when you said Bloomingdale's, I wondered whether the flickering lights might be productive, and when you mentioned motion pictures, but of course all sorts of stress situations can produce them. I would always get a migraine myself after a performance of some sort if I got excited. I love teaching, but I would get very nervy beforehand, and I always taught on Friday, and within... It usually went well, but 5 minutes after it ended, I saw stars. And if I didn't get excited about the teaching, I didn't get a migraine. But if I didn't get excited, I didn't teach well. So I reckoned it was worth it.
Migraine is usually associated with an upset stomach.
Well, one often has a lot of nausea, and they're sometimes called sick headaches. One can also get all sorts of strange visual disturbances. But, yeah, that was my first book. Then my second book was about an extraordinary population of patients who'd all had a strange sleepy sickness, encephalitis, around 1920, and had been in an odd trance-like state for 40 years. And in the late 60s, we found a drug, L-DOPA, which could awaken them and change everything. And this was an astonishing thing for these people to come alive, sometimes feel it was 40 years earlier. It was it had a quality of myth or legend, like Rip Van Winkle or whatever. Incidentally, this is being made into a film at the moment. I've just come from the set, and Robert De Niro is acting one of these patients, and Robin Williams is acting the doctor, is acting me. And it's astonishing to see the events of 1969 being recreated by great actors like this. I think it'll be called The Awakening.
The man who mistook his wife for a hat, that was a bestseller. That was a surprise hit, wasn't it?
Right, yeah. No, that was the book I wrote before Seeing Voices. That was a collection of, I call them clinical tales, but stories of patients with various things. Of their survival and their adaptation, often with ingenuity and humour. I think this is a point which joins it to the present book on Seeing Voices, because my interest is survival. How do people manage? in the man who mistook his wife for a hat, nothing could be recognized visually. There were all sorts of strange mistakes, including mistaking his wife for a hat. Although when this happened in front of me, I never thought it would become the title of a book. But the man who does this adapts by organizing the world musically instead of visually. The deaf, of course, organize the world visually, and with them it's a communal adaptation. They have created a language. But I was amazed, and my publishers were amazed, at the popular success of the man who mistook his wife for a hat. And I think there must be some... I don't quite know why it is. I think people are fascinated by questions of brain and mind. I think they're fascinated. I think they're moved by stories of pathos and heroism, and properly presented. I think a case history is and should be dramatic, not melodramatic, but you know, but truly dramatic and poignant. I think they may be reassured somewhat at the spectacle of a medicine which hasn't become too technical, and of a doctor who is a human figure and listens to his patients. I don't know. I still get an enormous mailbag, and people keep writing me letters. They say, "How is Jimmy, the lost mariner, the man who lost his memory?" You know, as if he's felt as a friend. And I think it's very astonishing how descriptions of situations which may seem so far from common experience, whether it's having some strange neurological disorder or being deaf, in fact somehow become a sort of allegory of what it is to be human.
You were born in England?
Yes, in London.
And where did you study?
Well, both my parents had trained as neurologists, and I followed in their footsteps and started training as a neurologist in England, and then I came over to this country in 1960.
And the rest is history. Well, Dr. Sachs, same voices. It's a very interesting book, and I certainly enjoyed reading it. And it's a book that tells you an awful lot about a segment of the population that we sometimes forget about. It's a wonderful book. Thank you very, very much.
It's been a pleasure being here. Thanks.